Our main speaker for the evening, Paul M. from San Diego.
Paul, alcoholic. And I'm here because I have alcoholism, and I want to thank Larry for asking me to share. It's always an honor to be here. My sobriety date is January 17th, 1994. This is my first time getting sober. And part of my story is kind of simple, and some of it's kind of funny, some of it's kind of tragic, but it's all my story. My first drink was a can of Colt 45 malt liquor. Somebody had said that if you put a straw in a beer and you drink it, right, you could get drunk, right? So that's the very first thing I did. I went and I stole this can of Colt 45 malt liquor, right? Stole it from a friend's dad's refrigerator, right? Went out to his backyard. We were doing this little camping trip, in the backyard. I don't know if anybody ever did that. When you're a kid, you go camping in the backyard, right? And so we steal this this can. I put a straw in it, and it worked. I got drunk. Right, and so all thing I remember was like just being so happy and so free and running around in circles, and I smacked right into a tree, and just out, right? And that was the story of my life for drinking. I kept smacking into stuff, over and over again. There's all these friendly warnings about my drinking as I'm getting older and getting older. Growing up. One of the friendly warnings was it was between my 8th and 9th grade year of school. I have 14, 15, however old you are then, is that I had started smoking a little bit of pot. And this friend of mine said that, they can get this chemical, get this stuff, and me, I just want to fit in. I want to be part of the cool crowd. I just want to fit in. And so we go get this white powder. They called it crystal tea. I have no idea what it was. I have no idea what it was, but and so we get back to his house, and I was supposed to be spending the night with him, and so he puts the tip of a knife blade in and snorts it, right, and then gives it to me, and I was supposed to do the same thing, right, so I do a little bit of it, didn't get any effect, and what I know now is that I'm there for the instant gratification, right, so there was a pen laying on the nightstand, I took the pen apart, shoved the pen, the tube down the bag, and everything went up my nose, and the next thing I remember, I'm waking up 3 days later in the hospital with tubes coming out of me that were crazy. So on through my life, all these friendly warnings over and over again, over and over again. Another friendly warning was there sometimes in the early 90s, my wife and I went to this marriage counselor, right? And I was trying to convince him that it's her fault, right? Anybody ever misinterpret the first step? It said, I'm powerless over alcohol. My wife had become unmanageable, right? Well, that's kind of like my hearing went, And so I'm in this therapist, because my drinking is progressing so quickly, right? And I can't control it. And so she thinks we need to go to therapy, and so I do this therapy, and I was convinced, without a shadow of a doubt, that I had convinced this therapist that it was her fault. And the last visit, as leaving his house, he slid a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous under my under my arm, and I looked at this thing, and I said, "Well, what the hell is this? There's no pictures in it. I'm not reading this thing." And the funny story about this particular one is that it sat on my coffee table at home, right? It sat on my coffee table. And there's a part in the book where it says we're building this arch so we walk through to freedom. Well, I didn't know what this thing was, but it was sitting on my coffee table. And as I would drink, I would build a pyramid above it. And I had no idea that I was actually doing what the book was talking about, right? Right, because every day when the wife got home from work, all the signs of my drinking had to be gone, right? There's an 18-pack or whatever it was, right? I could drink all day long, but as long as the evidence was gone, I thought I was okay, right? So over and over again, all these friendly warnings, that say, you shouldn't be doing this, right? Job after job, I lost. I can see my first drink was that Colt 45 malt liquor, and then it progressed to a point where, I had that experience with those drugs and OD'd, and then my mother thought, right, we lived in Greenville, South Carolina at the time, And my mother thought it was those people that caused me that problem, right? It was them, right? So she can just get me out of Greenville, South Carolina, and move me up to this little farming community in northeastern Indiana called Rome City, Indiana. And the only thing there are just bars, cornfields, factories, and fishing. That's it. And what do you suppose a fine, upstanding young man like myself did as soon as I got there? It had nothing to do with the people, places, or things. I found different people in different places and did the same thing over and over again. And it just gradually kept progressing on and on and on. And another one of these little friendly warnings, that might have been a problem. I was working as a machinist in this shop, and one of the owners was a paraplegic. He was in a wheelchair, and we went to his house for a party, and I got drunk and put the moves on his wife, and the next day I lose my job. Right? So you'd think that I would learn about these things, but it just never could learn. Right? Another one of these friendly warnings. Right? And this just keeps going all throughout my entire life. This friend of mine, he was a friend, an actual friend, right? And his dad owned the company that I worked for, right? It was a machine shop. And I got mad at him, and I caught him behind the store, right? I had him meet me here behind the store, and without even knowing it, I walked up and knocked the shit out of him. And knocked him out, and his foot went off the brake, went on the gas pedal, he did a 360 and smacked right in the back of his store, right? And just totaled his car. He was in the hospital for a month. And so once they found out it was me, they fired me, right? And then so all through my entire life, there were little signs that something was wrong, but I just wasn't listening. There were just signs that something was wrong. And so in Indiana, after this happened, after me punching this guy and losing my job, I couldn't buy a job in northeastern Indiana. This was the early 80s. I just couldn't buy a job because the economy was going to crap, and right. So I decided I'd join the Navy, serve my country, right. And I wish I could say I did it out of respect for the country, and but no, I just needed to get the hell out of town, right? Because I had my second DUI in Indiana, so I decided I would join the Navy, and the only reason why I chose the Navy were just two reasons. Yeah, you could drink and you played chess. I never played a single game of chess in the Navy the whole time I was there. But it just kept getting this illness that I have, and I had no idea at the time what was going on. It just kept progressing. In hindsight, you can see it. When I first got sober is that I looked at the first step, and this was my first time getting sober, like I said, and I noticed the first step was written in past tense. And so it allowed me to kind of think back at the time. I had no idea about any of this stuff as it was going on. But when I got sober, I started thinking back on my drinking career, all these little friendly warnings, and everything fit. Everything was in place. When I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink. And I never knew that. Nobody ever told me that. We didn't have that discussion at the dinner table. We didn't have the discussion at the bar, right? Hey, Joe, how's your phenomenon craving going? Right. Nobody ever mentioned that to me. So how am I supposed to know these things until I get here? And you talk about this phenomenon craving. And so it kind of progresses, and I'm starting to get a little bit of trouble in the Navy, but my work ethics are outstanding. That's why, it was back in the day where you could still drink and party and raise hell, in the Navy, and they kind of liked that, liked a little bit of rebel in the Navy, Today, I think if you look at somebody wrong, you're gone. But back then, it wasn't like that. And so one little escapade was that we were just pulling out for our first Westpac. And as we're pulling out, we're between here and Hawaii, just a day or two out. And I get a letter from the American Red Cross that said my biological father had just died. Well, I never knew this man. He was a drunk. He left my mom and six kids back when I was 6 or 7 years old, right? So my mom was raising six kids in the Deep South, right? So I never knew this guy. But the American Red Cross found it necessary or thought it necessary to notify me, right? And so my first response is, well, screw him. And I wadded it up and threw it away. And all of a sudden, I got this idea that I get emergency leave. Right? Right? So as I pull this piece of paper out of the trash can, smooth it out, put this little sad face on, and I'm good with, I can manufacture some tears. Right? I go to the chief engineer, and next thing I know, I'm being catapulted off the Kitty Hawk. Right? And so for the next month, between Guam, Diego Garcia, San Diego, I did nothing but party. I never made it to the funeral, never made it. I made it back to San Diego for a short period of time, but that was about it. And finally, the Navy got wise to that, and they said, "You need to go back, right? Because I'm starting to get in trouble here, right? I'm starting to get in trouble, back here." They said, "You don't belong here. You got to go." And so they gave me these orders that said, "Fly to Manila." Right? And so I, because that's where the ship is, and it's in Olongapo, right, in the Philippines. And so as I flew to Manila. And as I'm riding this little jeepney back from Manila down to Olongapo where the ship is, it occurs to me that I had completed these orders. It said fly to Manila, and it didn't tell me what to do after that, right? And so I partied my ass off, right? Just for the next 3 days, 5 days, whatever it was, until I ran out of money. And then I'm standing there on this pier where a ship is supposed to be, and it's not. Right. So they arrest me for missing an appointed place of duty, and I'm in handcuffs, and I'm hungover. God, I'm in bad shape. I can barely walk, barely breathe, barely talk. And so they fly me back out to the Kitty Hawk, and the master at arms comes, gets me, and they arrest me, and throw me in a brig, and I have these orders, and I say, how can I be charged with missing an appointed place of duty when I wasn't given one? And the military is kind of strict about things like that, But they didn't give it to me, so it pissed them off. They had to let me go. Right, because they didn't tell me precisely what to do, and I'm just a dumb little kid, right. But the fact of the matter is that I know how to play a system. Is that I know how to play a system, and so on and on through my life, all this stuff just kept happening, all these little friendly warnings, all over and over again, and so I barely made it out of the Navy with an honorable discharge, right? And my first job was I'm gonna make it. I'm going to be somebody. Like Bill Wilson talks about in his story, the drive for success was on. I'll prove to the world I'm important. And so the drive for success was on, and I started going to school, I was in restaurant maintenance, with Godfather's Pizza, servicing all their restaurants, right? And I had the keys to their place, so I'd go in and help myself to pizza at night. And the best thing of all about these places was they had box wine. Right, I could go in at night because I'm the meanest guy, and I had an endless supply of boxed wine. I'd just take it home, put it in my garage. Right, boxed wine. Right, and I was familiar with this kind of stuff because I drank a lot of Boone's Farm and Ripple as a kid. Right, anybody familiar with Boone's Farm? Oh yeah, that's good stuff. And so I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and where the chapter more about alcoholism, as we read it every meeting, says only drinking natural wines. I mean, I understood that completely, right? Because back then, if it had a cap on it, it was not natural. There's no grapes in that stuff, right? And, I mean, I totally understood that, So, right? And so over and over again, I'm starting to, this illness is progressing to where I can get a job, but I just can't keep it, right? And one of my other ones was I was the engineer at the Hotel Del running their power plant. And at this time, I had acquired this taste for copper, right? Recycled copper. It was everywhere, right? You beat it in the trades, you can get it, right? And so there was a bunch of copper wire laying around, and I would pick it up and I would strip it, and that's my drinking money. I worked from midnight to like 8 in the morning all the time. And so at nighttime, I would have to stop in the bar before I went to work. So most of the time, I was pretty drunk by the time I got to work. Yeah, but yet I was all by myself, so I had time to sleep it off a little bit and then get my work done, because after all, I'm an overachiever when it comes to things like that, right? And so one night I show up drunk, right, with you, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, I come to and I wake up and all these alarms are going off in their mechanical room, and I look out the window, and there's a fire in the generator. right? Right, it's burning. And so I got the fire extinguisher and I put it out and, you know, kind of focused a little bit and, you know, take a deep breath. You know, you can do this, you know, just, right? But my eyes wouldn't focus. I was still pretty much hungover and drunk, and my eyes wouldn't focus. And there's a particular, you know, there's a way of doing this, of getting the hotel back on utility, right? Reestablishing power for the hotel. I screwed it up and blew up the generator, right? And then my adrenaline is going so much that there's a breaker, right? That you actually can, you know, can do it again, right? Right, this backup system. And I'm doing this, and the handler comes off in my hand. Right, so the hotel's dead. It's the middle of the night. I'm drunk. Right, the bosses are coming in. And I've stolen all the copper. Right, because I didn't know this, but I found out at this particular moment. Right, that all that wire that was laying around was intended for such cases such as this. And they were going to use this wire as a jumper so they could jump the breaker and get the hotel back on, and, you know, Larry Lawrence would be happy. It didn't work out that way because I had stolen all the copper, right? And, you know, I mean, how can you kind of skirt around that one, right? You're there, and right? And so my next job was, right? So this just started happening like this. I could get a job, but I couldn't keep it. I was studying refrigeration at the time and plumbing and electrical, right? Because I'm going to be somebody, you know? I'm going to learn this stuff. I'm going to be good. And so I went to work for this university, and it was a nice spring day again. And, you know, it came time to drink. It came time, you know, to kind of do some stuff. And I climbed up on top of the cafeteria and cut their heating system out because it's all copper, right? And off I went to the scrapyard, right? So I lost that job too. Can you imagine that? Over and over again. I was a thief to support my habit. I was a thief to support alcoholism. There's no other way of putting it. And so as time went on, the last job I got before I got sober was an apartment complex. And by this time, I can't put anything down for references, right? Because I've been fired for being a drunk. I can't hold a job. I'm unemployable. And it's pretty clear. I'm just unemployable. So this last job, my wife's friend had to lie, right, when they called him, right? And so I got this job, and what happened there is again, I'm a thief, right? And I went in, and I found these checks, and I forged some names, and I walked into this bank, and by doing legitimate business, I knew that they would call and verify funds. But for some reason, I walked into that bank anyway. Kind of like calling the cops on yourself. Kind of like asking for help. You know, I said, you know, I'm just tired of this spiral. I mean, everything is just going out of control. Right? The house is being foreclosed on. The truck is being repossessed. I can't hold a job. I've just gone through 9 jobs in 4 years. Right? I'm unemployable. I'm getting ready to go to prison. Right, I go to jail over and over again. I've got 6 DUIs, 1 on a bicycle. Right, it is possible. Right, right, and so, but I can't see a problem. I can't see it. Everybody around me can see it. If anybody in this room were to see my criminal record back there, right, back then, you would have no problem identifying whether you knew me or not. This guy's got a drinking problem. I mean, everybody knew it but me. The doctor knew it. The therapist knew it. He said, here's a big book. Right? Everybody knew it but me. And I could not see it. I couldn't see what was so clear to everybody else. That's the type of delusion, the type of mind that I had. I couldn't see the truth that was right in front of me. And what happened? Because of this check that I wrote that I stole. Right, I tried to go to work the next morning, which is early Sunday morning, January 16th, 1994. And the owner of the apartment complex was there, my boss was there, and they handed me my last check and said, the sheriff's department's coming to get you. Right, and what do you think a guy like me would do with something like that? I went home to a wife that's divorcing me, to a house that's being foreclosed on, right? And I hopped in a truck that's being repossessed, and I said, I got to go. I got to figure out how to get out of this one. My whole life was exactly that same way. I was always living on the edge, and I would always think, if I could just get out of this one, I'll never put myself in this position again. I'll never do this again. And I meant it. I honestly meant it. You know, every time I told my wife or told somebody that, you know, that I wasn't going to drink or wasn't going to, you know, miss work again, I wasn't lying. I was not lying. I meant it with every fiber I am. I meant it. But the problem is I'm powerless over alcohol, and it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what decision I make. Alcohol controls me. I went to this wedding one time, and I was the best man, and the bride and the bride's parents were very adamant. They were Christian folk, nice people. And they were very adamant, no alcohol at the service. And what do you think a cocky guy like me does? I spiked the punch bowl. I mean, over and over and over again, it just little... I mean, people in this room would laugh. What do you think the regular people would do? Right? They'd look at me like I'm nuts, but you guys laugh. Right? Because you get it. You know, if I'm at a party, we're going to be drinking. Right? That it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whose party it is. If it's my six-year-old little girl, if she's having a party, I'm drinking. Just the way it is. And so I went to this house that's being foreclosed on, and a wife that's divorcing me, and in a truck that's being repossessed, and I said, I got to go. And so I made arrangements to go to API the next day. Because not to get sober, right? I have no intention of getting sober. I have no idea what's going on. My only thought is I got to hide. I got to figure out how to get out of this one. Right, because over and over again, I would say, if I could ever get out of this, I'll never put myself in this position again. And there I was in a big one. So I need time to think. And so I'm scurrying around San Diego, you know, like a little rat, and I wind up in Balboa Park, and you're hitting a crack pipe. I'm not an addict, but you know, crack was pretty good. I'm not an addict at all. Right, I can take it or leave it. But I'm sitting here in Balboa Park with this other guy, I don't even know who it was, a homeless guy I'm partying with, right? And hitting this pipe, and all of a sudden the Northridge earthquake hit. Anybody remember the Northridge earthquake? That's my sobriety date. And at that moment, those cops had much more important stuff to do than look for me. Right? They had much more, the town was on fire, you know? I mean, I'm just, you know, they'd get me later. And so I went ahead and went to this treatment center, and I can remember the very first time, the second morning there, and I'm standing now on this bridge that overlooks Interstate 8, and the world is going to work, and you don't care if I'm there or not. I am not that important. My life doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of things. I mean, that was kind of a smack in the face to a narcissistic, ego-driven guy like me. Right, to where it didn't matter if I was there or not, the world was going to continue. When I always pictured the world evolved around me, and if not, get the hell out of my way, I'll show you. But now I'm hiding out like a scared little kid. And in this treatment center, thank God for treatment centers. I'm serious. Thank God for treatment centers. Thank God that they introduced me to this theory that my body may not metabolize alcohol. Well, who the hell knew that? I mean, seriously, right? I've been drinking my whole life. My whole family drank. Everybody I knew drank, right? Where they talked about, you know, the DUIs. You know, they talked about, you know, cirrhosis of the liver. I talked about losing families because of this. But nobody ever said that the physical body of the alcoholic doesn't metabolize alcohol correctly. And what happens, it establishes a craving that once I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink. I went, shit. You know, you ever had a piece of news on one side answered a ton of questions, and on the other side was, oh shit, what am I going to do now? Right? So it's kind of like this double-edged sword with the good and the bad. Right? And so with that, just that piece of information, I spent 10 days in API, and what I witnessed and what I saw were people who had been in and out like a revolving door, right? In and out like a revolving door. One guy had been there 10 times, and they kept taking him, right? And I didn't understand that, right? Because how could somebody do this more than twice? And you're not, you can't possibly be serious, or you know, or you don't feel like I feel, right? And so from this treatment center, the house is gone. The wife, you know, and the cops are still looking for me, right? And so I go to this place called Pathfinders, right? And something happened when I walked through those doors, and I had this overwhelming feeling that this is where I needed to be. And when I first sobered up, I stuttered. I couldn't carry on a conversation. And so some of the meetings that I'd been to through API, there was all these things about God and, you know, to find God or die or get a sponsor and call him every day. And, right, only one thing you got to change is everything, which really pissed me the fuck off. Right? Really made me mad. Right? Because I didn't understand the lingo here. And I wanted to understand the lingo. And so I go to this place, Pathfinders, and these guys kind of laughed at me, you know, because I stutter, I can't talk, but the words I can get out, I'm excited about this information, this little piece of information I have about the phenomenon I'm craving, and they kind of laugh at me and they say, "That's not your problem. That's not your problem. This phenomenon I'm craving is not your problem. Your problem is the most insane thing you do stone cold sober." I said, "Well, wait a minute. You haven't seen my record yet. You haven't seen my criminal record yet. There's pretty insane things in there." And they said, "No, the most insane thing you could possibly do, you do stone cold sober, and that's pick up a first drink." Whoa. And that's true. The most insane thing, I mean, in light of everything that happens to me, in light of all the jobs, all the hurt feelings, all the broken promises, all the public intoxications, all the car wrecks, I mean, the list is endless. I'm unable at certain times to bring into my consciousness with sufficient force the memory, the suffering, and the humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And there's not a single thing I can do about that. Because you'd think that my experience would be enough to keep me sober? Huh. My experience is not enough to keep me sober. Or else I wouldn't be standing here today. Right? My experience has never been, because I have this mind, it's called a peculiar mental twist. The book refers to it as a peculiar mental twist, to where there's a certain time, and not all the time, I can think through the drink 98% of the time or 99% of the time, right? I can play that tape through all the way, right? I can see the consequences 99.9% of the time. That's not my problem. My problem is where this peculiar mental twist paralleled with my sound reasoning that if I just put, just have a little crystal before the beer, I'll be okay. Right, that I won't get these DUIs because I'll be wide awake. And yet I wind up going to jail anyway. This time I'm wide awake instead of sleeping. Right, so it's called a peculiar mental twist where my sound reasoning fails to hold me in check. And there's no way that I can plan on this. There's no way I can have the right sponsor, go to enough meetings, do what you call service work. There's no way I can do any of that to prevent that from happening. Unity was never intended for recovery. One drunk talking to another was never intended for recovery. What had to happen in my case is this thing had to shift. I had to look at the world differently, but I got this thing going on. I got a couple of different things, what I considered handicaps back then, and in hindsight, they were just prejudiced. Right? And the two things that I considered handicap was I couldn't talk to you, I stuttered. And if you tried to finish my sentences, I punched you. And I was molested as a kid, right, in this church, right, by these two deacons of the church, Southern Baptist version, right? And so you come in here and men want to hug me and love me till I love myself, and they, right, I know that ain't happening, right? And so my mind slammed shut because I understood the two questions of the first step. There's only two questions. When I start to drink, can I guarantee how much I'm going to drink? And the second question is, if somebody who loved me asked me to stop, can I stop and stay stopped? Those two I got, right? So I know that it's not a question of if I drink, it's a question of when. That's what powerless means. And I can't do it on my own. But then you start talking about God, and then all of a sudden my mind slams shut, and I go, I can't do this. I don't understand what you're talking about. And these guys, and I was about 6 months sober, and this is where my world changed. Right? I was about 6 months sober, sitting in a meeting, and I'm coming apart at the seams. I got no spirit in me. All I got is just this, and no alcohol, no relief, no God, no nothing. And I'm coming apart at the seams, and a guy from the podium, he's taking a 10-year cake, and he's this little angry chief, right? Just little spitfire of a man. And he says, when the book says to pray, you pray. When it says to write, you write. When it says to talk to somebody else, do that. And so I picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because whether I'd heard that before, I heard it that time. So I picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and started actually studying that piece of literature. Right? And that saved me. There's a part in there in the foreword to the first edition where it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we've recovered is the main purpose of this book. Right? So I said, okay, so they're going to show me precisely how they recovered. And then I would go to meetings and I'd hear people say, you're always in recovery, you're never going to recover. And that really confused me. So I'd go up to them and I'd ask them, is it that you can't or you won't completely give yourself to this simple program? I mean, I'm seriously, I mean, I'm brand new in this program, and I'm hearing things that contradicted one another. I did not understand the difference between the fellowship is one version of AA and the book is an entirely different version of AA. I did not understand that. I do now, but then I didn't. So I started reading on in this book, and I understood that anywhere in that book, not the fellowship, but anywhere in that book where they use the word we, they're talking about the first 100 people who wrote the book. And if I want to recover from this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, I would do precisely what they said to do. And I did that. When they say to pray, I prayed. Right? The first prayer in the book is we ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Right? The second prayer is the third step prayer. Right, so I followed those 100 people's instructions because I didn't trust you. At that time, I could not trust you. My whole life, I was separated from humanity. I had no bond with anybody, no emotional bond with anybody. Not my 8 sisters, not my 3 brothers, right? Not my stepdad, not my mother, not my children. Had no emotional bond with anybody. Scared to even let you know who I was, even a little bit. I'd keep you at a distance because if you know me, you can hurt me. So I kept you at a distance. And so I walked in here into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would hear people stand up and they would pontificate, and then the guy they were giving the token to, he would say, well, tell him how you did it. Yeah. And it confused me. All this stuff confused me. Right? And so I followed the first 100 people's directions. And I did the inventory precisely as they described. And I got a sponsor to help me with this. Not for me to call him every day. I used to go up to people when I was new. And I would ask him to help me with this program, but don't share your opinion with me. That's kind of hard to do, isn't it? Right, and so they would run from me, right? Because I was nothing but angry, right? I was afraid, right? And it would come out as anger, you know? And so they would run from me. And so I did this work as directed from the book, and I read this fifth step off to a guy named Irish Patrick, right? He was a guy hanging out at Pathfinders. And something happened. Something happened right after this fifth step. It was the most incredible thing that I had ever experienced. My mind slowed down enough for me to talk. If it hadn't been for that process, because I don't know if you've ever met anybody who stutters, right? But the mind moves too fast for the vocal cords to translate. That is the problem. Most people who stutter are alcoholics. Even if they're this big, they're going to be alcoholics. Right? Chances are, right? Because the mind is moving too fast, and the only thing that's going to slow it down is a big old fatty and a quart of beer. That's the only thing that's going to make it tolerable. And so, still in Pathfinders, and I was there for 30 days, right, on my 30th day of sobriety. I kept looking out the window, waiting for the cops to come get me, right, because they committed these crimes, right? I kept, you know, just waiting for the cops to come get me and said, shit, I can't do this, right? So I went down to the Lemon Grove Sheriff Station, the substation down there, right? And I told the people at Pathfinders only. I didn't tell anybody else. Right? I told the staff what I was doing. I had a letter of residency from API, a letter of residency from Pathfinders, and I went down, and I walked into the sheriff's substation, and I told the lady behind the counter who I was, and you're investigating some crimes, and I'm the guilty one. I'm here to turn myself in. And she said, "There's nobody here. You got to come back later." True story. That's a God's honest true story. I mean, I could have been a serial killer. He's got to come back later. No, I'm just a drunk felon. So I went out and sat in my truck. And at that moment is where alcohol surrendered me. See, I don't think I ever surrendered. Alcohol became a great persuader. It finally beat me into a state of reasonableness. I knew, sitting there in my truck with have this thought, well, see, I tried, so I can go to back the Pathfinders, pack my stuff, move to Mexico. Right? It, I mean, that's how my mind thinks. And so as I'm sitting there, all the stuff I had just learned in the first 30 days that I'm going to drink again. It doesn't matter what I think, how I say, where I am, I'm going to drink again. And so I sat there and I went back in. Alcohol persuaded me to do this, nothing else. Not your words, not the attorney, not the threat of going to prison. Right? Alcohol persuaded me that I needed to do something different. For the first time in my life, I had to get as honest as I could possibly be about everything that I had done. Everything. And for a guy who is a curtain peeker, anybody here know what a curtain peeker is? All right, any curtain peekers in the room? Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that was me. I live alone. I exist alone. Right, and at that moment is when I decided to drink the Kool-Aid around here, and I'm coming back in. And I sat down, and I waited. And these detectives came in, and they arrested me, and I went I went to three courts in like 3 days. And the last one said, just go finish up Pathfinders and come back and see us. And so I went back to Pathfinders, and that was way back when the county was not involved with the place, right? There was not, you know, it didn't matter if you were on probation or whatever it was. It didn't matter, right? You were there voluntarily, and they could kick you out at any time if you screwed up. And they did. It's not like that today because of county funding. But anyway, that's a story for another time. And so I stayed there, and during this process, something internally happened. When I said, when I did my first fifth step, my mind slowed down enough for me to communicate. And something amazing has happened through this whole process, is that same scared kid is no longer that way. I have a life beyond my wildest imagination. You know, there's a part in anybody familiar with the third step promises? It says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. I have a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what I needed if I kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, I become less and less interested in myself. Huh. Imagine that. A narcissistic guy like me becoming less and less interested in myself and my little thoughts and plans. Then I feel new power flow in. I enjoy peace of mind. How many people in this room can say they enjoy peace of mind? Absolutely. Right? I begin to lose my fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I'm reborn. Now, this is an incredible set of promises here that I could only dream of as a kid. Right? You know, that I can only dream of the internal stuff. See, the illness that I have has nothing to do with you. Absolutely nothing to do with you. Doesn't have to do with anything, people, places, or things. I have no triggers. If I believe I have a trigger, then I put a condition on my sobriety, and I would have never gotten and stayed sober. If I believed I know what the day looked like when I was going to drink, then I would try to arrange my life around that day or that plan or my mom dying. I would have tried to arrange my life around that, and I never would have succeeded. Never would have succeeded. If I think I have triggers and I put a condition on my sobriety, I have a lurking notion that if I just do this, everything's going to be okay. And so these men helped me understand what this illness is. This illness is internal. And there's a part, and I don't know if you guys picked it up on this yet, but I'm pretty much a book thumper. Right? Some of these guys know, right? I don't care. I mean, if you're in the program, why not know the book? Right? Because it's the program. I mean, why not know the book? And so I do. Right? And so, you know, this thing, it works for me. And so what happened to me in the second step and how I was able to do this is on page 46, it says, much to our relief, we discovered we didn't need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect contact with him. And so this version of God that I was so afraid of, the book told me that I could have my own conception. And then it refers to it on page 55 as a feeling of a friend. And I got that. You know, I know what that feels like, a feeling of a friend. And so they told me that's what your God is, a feeling of a friend. And so as I would go through this process of these inventories and this life of mine, this is what comes to mind, the third set promises. You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, this thing is very simple. And I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but sometimes humanity really screws it up. Sometimes humanity screws up this program beyond recognition. It's because sitting in this room, and you probably heard this before from other speakers because I copied this from a guy. Right? Sitting in this room, right, you got the bank president, you got the bank teller, and you got the bank robber. Right? Sitting in this room, right? There were people who normally wouldn't mix. But internally, we have one thing in common, is that this craving, this allergy, right? Once I start to drink, I can't guarantee how much I'm going to drink. And people who have that understand that and can relate to that. But the issue comes with the practical program of action to treat this. What I believe is that if the program is altered in any way, shape, or form, if the program from the big book is altered, and I've been sober a long time and I do this 2-3 times a day, right? I'm in meetings 2-3 times a day and talking to drunks 2-3 times a day. And what I've experienced the last 15 years is I've yet to meet somebody in the last 15 years who's taken the steps precisely from the book. And that's a tragedy. That is a tragedy. The inventory's been altered. Write out a first step. Write out a second step. Let's sit down and read the book together. You didn't get sick overnight. You're not going to get well overnight. All this stuff. And stay away from people, places, and things. Stay away from that barbershop. You're going to get a haircut? I don't need a fucking haircut. Right? All these things that have nothing to do with sobriety. Nothing, you know. But the people who are telling me this or telling that have no malice in their heart. It's just how they were taught. And what it winds up is this telephone game, and by the time it goes all the way around the room, it's something entirely different. It starts out here, you're a chronic alcoholic, you're never going to get sober, and back here, it just don't drink no matter what. And it's no fault because I'm a firm believer that if I change one single thing, I'll share this and then sit down. And the reason that I have this attitude is because my first couple years of sobriety, I sponsored a guy. I sponsor plenty of people now. But the first guy the first guys I sponsored got drunk and died. Right? He got drunk, passed out, hypothermia got him on the sidewalk. I'd never been around people, so nobody died. Right? I was always an isolator, so this was the first person that I even, or one of the first people that I tried to get close to. Right? That I tried to do what I thought I was supposed to do, and he died. He got drunk and died, and then all of a sudden my mind starts to spin. Well, what did I do wrong? Right? What did I do wrong? Did I screw him up? Right? Was there something I didn't tell him right? And so at that moment, and I've stuck to this, is I made a decision that I was never going to change the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not going to be responsible for your sobriety, and I'm not going to be responsible for your getting drunk. My job is to present this message as it's written in the book, and not my version, because I would love to hide my ego and this is my experience. Right? I'd love to hide my ego and this is my experience, but I don't. I hide my ego in the knowledge of the book. And so, one thing that guys know me, and I tell them this, is that I will not share an opinion with anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything that I will share with you personally comes straight from the book. It's not an opinion. But if it goes against what your sponsor says, then it's an opinion, right? It's sad. I was just in Northern California, and I go to meetings everywhere I go, and I was just in Northern California, and they were making a group announcement that they were going to get together to have a panel and find out what's going on with Alcoholics Anonymous up here. And so I started kind of chuckling a little bit. I mean, but I did. Right? And so after the meeting, somebody says, well, what's funny? I said, the same people who are screwing it up are going to sit down and have a panel and talk about what's wrong. I mean, you see the irony in that? You know, and what it boils down to is this, and I'll close with this, is that in Bill Wilson's story, Bill writes, simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant the destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. So Bill Wilson, one of the co-founders of this program who wrote the book, wrote that other thing too, right, wrote the book, he knows that his biggest problem is his self-centeredness. And then what does he do? He goes out and writes a book as Bill sees it. Thanks for letting me share.